Hello, welcome to the House of Comments. This is a podcast about politics. We used to do it regularly, we now do it infrequently on special occasions, and I can't really think of an occasion more special than 2 days after the general election, where Theresa May has lost her majority and Jeremy Corbyn has won quite a lot of seats that I don't think anyone really, or at least most people, were expecting him to win. So we're actually all face to face today. So I'm joined by Labour activist Emma Burnell. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
And I'm joined by Nick Dennis, Conservative activist.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Emma.
Hi. I'm also joined by Tim Worthington, cultural commentator. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Right. So where do we start with this? Nick. What are your thoughts? Let's start with you, seeing as you know, we do want to intrude on private grief. How do you feel? You were probably expecting maybe a majority of like 60, 80, something like that. What you've actually got is a majority of -8.
How do I feel? To be honest, before we started recording this podcast, when we were just having a nice little chat and having our brunch, I felt very nice and happy. I was looking outside the blue sky and the flowers in my garden. But as soon as I have to start talking about politics, suddenly this black mist has appeared over my head and I've got my head in my hands. And
it is a nice garden if you just want to keep looking out the window.
Just sit in the garden. I'm depressed. I'm politically depressed, Mark.
What do you think? I mean, we'll obviously unpack some of the details of the campaign, but just kind of, you know, what's your kind of soundbite impression of what happened and what went wrong?
So essentially what happened in big terms is that we were expecting UKIP to be like a gateway drug towards us. We were expecting them to take sort of Labour supporters, white working class or Labour supporters, away from Labour into UKIP and then onto us, because breaking that link with Labour. Now, I think roughly only about maybe 50% or under 50% of those people came to us. What happened is when a lot of those people came to the ballot box and their pens were hovering over the ballot paper, they just couldn't vote Conservative. So fundamentally, we still have this really big problem that a lot of people see us as a nasty party. And that is, all the other stuff is detail, which we'll get onto, but fundamentally, we still have the same problem we've had for the last 20 years.
And ironically, it was Theresa May who identified that problem 15 years ago.
Yes.
It's actually what kind of launched her into the public consciousness, wasn't it?
It is, and we just, you know, we haven't dealt with it. And, it's always... Always with these things, you sort of hark back to things that you think prove you right. But at the beginning of this campaign, I wrote a blog for Conservative Home saying this was a chance for us to do a positive campaign, talk about why the Conservatives care, because there'll be a whole load of people who never would normally listen to us who will listen to us. But of course, that was ignored, and we went for the Linton Crosby repeating the same soundbite again and again and again. But ultimately, these people who were trying to convince wanted to know, okay, you're strong and stable, but what does that mean? Does it mean you're strong and stable evil Tories? And because we never went on to the second point, we didn't actually win. We win the argument with them, and I think that's what, you know, that was one of the major strategic errors I made during the campaign.
I've got to say, you know, as a soundbite, strong and stable evil Tories is not what I would have gone for. Maybe Linton Crosby isn't as good as I thought.
I tell you what, if I can get my hands on a bus,
a blue bus. Okay, so Emma, what are your initial impressions about what happened and where we are now? Because you're probably as surprised as the rest of us.
Yeah, I struggled to get my jaw off the floor when the exit polls came out.
You and Nick were actually on live radio at the time, weren't you?
We were, and I mean, I'll be completely candid. We went for a quick Coca-Cola before the radio show, and we were sort of swapping notes of where do you think we are, where are we going to be? And we both thought, I don't think we were being ridiculous to think that we thought it was going to be a fairly comfortable Tory majority, less possibly than had been expected at the beginning of the campaign, because it had been a poor campaign. But still, Labour were very worried. We thought we were going to lose a lot of MPs. And Nick and I had done the same radio show in 2015 when Labour were quite bullish about what our chances were. And we sat in a room and the exit poll came out and my head went in my hands and Nick's fist went in the air. And we had an exact mirroring of that this time around.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually on air with BBC Radio Kent at the time. And we did a little straw poll just before the exit poll came out. And everyone was anywhere ranging from between 40 seats and 80 seats majority for the Tories. And then, of course, the exit poll came out and it was like, ah, OK, this is going to be a more exciting night than I thought it was going to be. And Tim, just from your perspective, I think you're not really as into politics as we are, let's say. Maybe you're the kind of token non-political geek. What's your impression of what happened, just from the perspective of a kind of, you know, voter and observer?
Well, I think one thing that hasn't been really captured enough, remarked on enough, and it was something that I completely missed, and I think everyone completely missed it, was we all concentrated on the attempts of not even the Corbyn campaign, but his supporters, his high-profile support groups, to connect with younger voters using their language, which looked embarrassing. I mean, that drawing of him dabbing and all that sort of thing. Just was really like, you know, that thing that turns up on Twitter with Steve Buscemi with the skateboard saying, "How do you do, fellow kids?" It was all like that. But in the meantime, he appears to be doing things like the grind for Corbyn thing, where nobody from the political side was taking control of that. It was people who supported him in other media, in other arts, were just coming up from nowhere saying, "I'll support you, hello, come and meet us," doing it on their terms. He turns up, he says, "Hello, I'm Jeremy Corbyn, hello, fans of whoever." Then they do their, you know, he doesn't stand around saying shabba, joining in with them. Which, is, to be fair, is what somebody that old and removed would think crime was. But they just then did their thing, and I think that's worked better than anyone expected. I really think that's had an impact.
I think that's a really good point. And I think what made that work, and you're absolutely right, is that came up from the grassroots and was not then taken over and controlled and anaesthetised by the central party. There was no anaesthetic put to it. There was no anaesthetic.
So it felt genuine, because it kind of was genuine.
And what's really interesting, and I hadn't really picked up, I picked up on it in a bit, but not in that way, but what's really interesting is it contrasts so much with the Conservative campaign, which was so rigid, so controlled.
Stayed.
And there was no, you know, there was no freedom, there was no organicness to it. So you're right, I think it even highlighted it even worse that Strong and Stable was actually flexible and was inflexible and brittle.
Well, I think there was some spontaneity in the Conservative campaign. I mean, they spontaneously locked two reporters in a cupboard in court. I don't think they planned to do that. I think they probably just improvised that on the day. My youngest brother, who isn't interested in politics at all, actually went to a Corbyn rally. They had a Corbyn rally in Runcorn, where he lives, and he heard about it, and he went down. He wasn't planning to, just did it on a whim, and he said the atmosphere was absolutely electric. It was rammed, and he couldn't believe how charismatic Corbyn was. You know, now to be fair to him, because he doesn't go to these things very often, it's possible he was, at the time I was thinking, oh, he was probably slightly, when he told me before the election result, that maybe he was just slightly overawed by the occasion because he doesn't go to those things. But actually, with the result as we now know, how many of those events did Corbyn do? How many potential voters went to see him?
But the fact it's the fact he went, which is really important
and
in that
what
as well.
I think a lot of people forget about Corbyn. You know, Corbyn, there are two roles to being a party leader. There's being the spearhead of a campaign, and then there's the party management bit. And we have been so focused on the fact that party management's not his thing. Never has been. You know, he was always the thorn in the side of the party managers. That's what he did. But what he has done for his entire life, you know, you read books about him, and from his teenage years, he was up on platforms campaigning, passionate, real. I care about this. I know nobody else cares about this, but I'm going to keep going. You don't get to where he's been and hone those skills over those years without being able to deliver at that kind of rally.
And that's an interesting point, actually, because that's one of the things I've been reflecting upon since the election result. I mean, we've obviously had, a day and a half to kind of digest this and think about this. And I used to think that Corbyn, he'd spent 32 years in Parliament when he first became leader. And I just thought, what's he been doing all of that time? Because he doesn't seem to understand how to run a party. He doesn't seem to understand about how politics works on a very basic level. He seemed to, because he wasn't really playing by the rules, in quotes, as I understand they're supposed to be played. And I just thought, this is going to end up catastrophic. But actually, the more I reflect upon this, the more I'm starting to think that he was playing a very canny game that he did actually understand. Well, I've seen a shake of the head from Nick and a shake of the head from Emma, so we'll come back in a minute. I'm just going to finish my thought first. So, for example, with the EU referendum issue, I thought that was just a really wishy-washy policy. It was a kind of nowhere policy. It wasn't really clear where the party stood, and therefore they weren't going to be able to convince Remainers that they were on their side, but they also weren't going to be able to convince Leavers that they were on their side, so they were kind of just going to be nowhere on that issue. What they actually managed to do was get people who voted for Remain to vote for the Labour Party and people who voted for Leave to vote for the Labour Party, precisely because they didn't nail their colours to the mast of either of those particular positions, and therefore they were actually able to win both people from both camps. And so rather than kind of falling between two stools, he was actually straddling two stools in a way that kind of Tony Blair would probably have been proud of. Nick?
Can I say why I disagreed with you? Because I really thought the first part of your comment was completely correct. Where I disagreed with you was that this was some sort of plan or this was some sort of cunning.
So you think he stumbled across it?
Well, no, I don't think he stumbled across it. You see, because I've got a Jeremy Corbyn story. I met Jeremy Corbyn 20 years ago. I'll just mention what that is. And I think it's all very enlightening on who he is. But roughly, you know, he's always been a genuine person who does what he feels is best and what he wants to do. And we're now in an age of politics where the centre's dead, the slogan's dead. It's actually about convictions. It's about presenting a vision, whether it's utopian or dystopian, if you're Donald Trump. And he is always... Jeremy Corbyn is being Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah, the world has changed around him.
Yeah.
And he is genuine. He is not a planner. So my Jeremy Corbyn story, which sort of says, was from 20 years ago. Now, I lived in Tufnell Park, which is in his constituency.
You should have only been a kid at the time.
Yeah, I was just finishing university, and I wrote to my local MP, who was Jeremy Corbyn, never heard of him.
Did you used to go to the Dome?
I did used to go to the Dome. I said, I'd like to go and see Prime Minister's question time, so that'd be all right. And his office rang back, said, yes, that'd be great. The tickets for about 6 months' time, but you can have a free tour of Big Ben next week if you want to. And so I went for a free tour of Big Ben. And then when it came to going to Prime Minister's question time, his office contacted me the day before and said, after it finishes, if you wait in the lobby, in the members' lobby, he'll come and pick you up and he'll have a coffee with you. So I went, saw Prime Minister's question time, Tony Blair and all that stuff. It was great. And I waited in the members' lobby, and then he came up to me, this sort of scruffy man came up to me and said, do you fancy a coffee? Took me to Paul Cullis' house, and I didn't really know much about politics because it was before I was that engaged. I was sort of broadly interested, and we just had a coffee for half an hour. We had this great chat. It was really funny. He basically, because it was around the time of the Iraq War, just before the Iraq War, and he said, oh yeah, in my constituency there's a lot of children who are leaving school, you know, to strike to leave school because they're protesting against the Iraq War. And he said most of them haven't been to school for ages. They're just turning up so they can walk out again. And he was saying stuff like that to me, and I was like, "Oh, an MP talking like that." But there was no sort of plan for him doing that. There was no, you know, obviously, if there was a plan, it failed miserably because I'm now a Conservative. But he was just being him. But
yeah, no, and I think this is a really key part of it. Is if it had been strategized to death, he wouldn't be able to deliver it. That's the point. And I think that one of the first things you said was, you know, he's not playing by the rules. And I think the thing about the rule book, and this is what the PLP, so the Parliamentary Labour Party, and those who have opposed him from the very beginning are now going to have to accept, is the rules have changed.
Yeah.
And we don't really know what the rules are now. But Corbyn could never have played by a rule book in that way. You know, that's not who he is. It, when he tries to do that, it doesn't work. It does come. And actually, what you've had a few times is that the party goes, this is what we're doing. And then someone interviews Corbyn, he's like, no, we're not.
But the thing is, that's exactly like Trump. Like, I know, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn and Donald Trump are completely different people and their politics in completely different places. But you could be talking about Trump there.
Yeah.
He doesn't play by the rules.
No, absolutely.
The rules have actually changed because he won.
And his office was sort of saying that they were going to follow that Trump-like strategy, and everyone took the mickey.
And yet it sort of worked.
And in terms of the Europe thing, I mean, I have to say that I thought it was the wrong thing to do, partly because I'm an angry Remainer. I am not part of those, what were they called, relievers. No, none of that for me. And my thinking was that we wouldn't get a snap election. I stupidly, I believe Theresa May.
So did I.
And yeah, I even booked a blooming holiday, which I did too. I should be in New York right now. So if I didn't dislike Theresa May before.
I have to say, Emma, that's real dedication to the cause. If I had a month in New York booked, I don't think anything would stop me. Not even a general election. You're obviously far more dedicated political activist than I am.
Yes, I am.
Mind you, it was worth it for Thursday evening, though.
Okay. Really, yeah, yes. Yeah. I wouldn't have swapped that. But in 3 years' time, we will have gone through Brexit. And my sense is that Brexit will never deliver what anybody wants it to, because expectations are so all over the place and so high.
Well, it's whatever people want it to be
exactly.
At the moment, isn't it?
And so eventually, when it becomes what it actually is, when we know what Brexit means, then I think that Brexit will be considerably less popular. And I thought Labour were putting themselves in the wrong... I thought you should be out ahead of that argument by opposing it from the start. Having had the snap election, we were in the right place for the snap election. So fair play to them for putting us in that position well beforehand.
OK, let's talk about what happened in the actual election and the immediate aftermath, because we are now, as I said, well, a couple of days on from election day. And it's looking like Theresa May isn't going to resign, at least yet. So we'll come on to that in a minute. But Labour has won seats. The Conservatives have lost seats. The Conservatives now have 318, I think. So it's a few short of a majority, although because Sinn Féin don't take their seats and the Speaker doesn't vote, they're only a very small number of seats. I think it's 3 seats away from having an effective majority. But they have decided that they're going to govern, I believe, as a minority, but with support from the DUP, the Democratic Unionist Party, who have 10 seats. That will give them a pretty slender majority. Nick, it's not going to take more than Ken Clark, Anna Soubry and Nicky Morgan to defeat the government now, is it?
Maybe. I mean, I think the key, one of the really important factors to sort of play into all of this is I don't think anybody wants another election. So
we are all Brenda.
Well, yeah, we are all Brenda. But
I quite like elections. Yeah, I get to go on the radio for 8 hours.
So I mean, to actually bring down the Conservative government in order to have another election, shall we use civil service speak, would be an extremely brave thing to do. Amber Rudd, her majority was cut to below 500, I think. Boris Johnson's majority was cut from about close to 11,000 to 4,500. Justin Greening's majority's been cut to 1,000. And those are a few examples of very high conservative, high-profile conservatives who will not want to rock the boat. So I think the Queen's speech will get through okay, but after that, there's going to be a lot of pain, a lot of negotiating and possibly not much legislation. Because you're right, getting coalition to do stuff is going to be hard. But also at the same time, I think no one really wants the Tory party to fall down and another election to be had.
Yeah, I mean, the question about another election is an interesting one, because I was convinced, actually, as the results came in and as it became clear what the composition of the parliament was going to be, that another election, say, in October, was actually going to be inevitable. And I think there's probably a few strands to this, because I can understand where you're coming from, Nick, that Tory MPs, having had the shock of losing colleagues they weren't expecting to lose, having their own majorities slashed to levels that now their seats are marginal or close to marginal. But at the same time, isn't there a... And maybe this is one for Emma. Isn't there a... Were there to be another election fairly soon... Isn't it likely that some people voted Labour because they thought there was no chance that Corbyn could be Prime Minister? And now that there's a chance that Corbyn could be Prime Minister at a subsequent election, because he's not that far away now, he probably only needs another 20 or 30 seats, and the Tories couldn't do it, and it would have to be Corbyn. So isn't it actually quite likely that if there was another election, those two things would counterbalance, and maybe the Tories would do quite well?
If I were a Tory MP, I wouldn't bet on that right now. No way. Momentum is with us in all ways. And, you know, and I've had my issues with momentum over the years. There has been some really nasty stuff that happens online if you are questioning of the Corbyn project, which I have been. And I've put my hands up. So at 10:01.
You've had some of this personally. Though.
I've had, yeah, oh yeah, God, the amount of times I've been called a Tory, I might as well join your party, Nick. But you know, I'm not a Tory. but to be fair to Momentum as an organisation, they got their activists on the ground. And I was out for Wes Streeting, who was one of the most vocal critics of Jeremy Corbyn, with young people with Corbyn T-shirts. All over the streets, and you know, and they did what we all do, and this is what I think a lot of people didn't reckon on, is that when it comes to it, the Labour Party hangs together, yeah. And we really did, and we spent 7 years actually remembering that we quite like each other, whereas the Conservatives,
or you hate us more than you hate each other.
No, that is certainly true, but no, actually, we remember what it's like to be a family. And I am not kidding. It felt nice for once. And, you know, it's been a tough couple of years in the Labour Party. But, it just feels like the wind is at our sails at the moment. We have comprehensively proved that the Sun and the Mail cannot do their nasty thing and actually touch us too badly. And, you know, they threw everything.
Yeah.
They threw everything
The Mail had 13 pages on Corbyn on election day, which I just thought it was massive overkill. I mean, I'm not a fan of Corbyn, and I knew they were going to highlight some of his... But 13 pages? You know, it's not, I don't know, it just seemed massively over the top.
But what I'm saying is they've left it all out on the field now. You know, what more, and what they'll do is go after the policies. Fine, I'm happy to have a political discussion. But yeah, I don't think that they can get any more vicious. I think that the wind is at our backs. We are now more united, and the we will stay more united. I'm not saying that, I mean, Chris Leslie was on the radio this morning not being particularly united, but actually a lot of other of Corbyn's critics have sort of rode in behind him. So I wouldn't, if I were a Tory backbench, under those circumstances. And the other thing is there's some very quick Fabian research, which has showed that we've more than twice we've narrowed the gap. So there are not just in terms of that we have taken a number of seats, but that there are now double the amount of marginals that we could win.
Yeah, whereas it was hard to see a path to Corbyn becoming it was almost impossible to imagine a path to Corbyn becoming Prime Minister before the election. And actually, even though obviously Labour did really, really well, it's worth bearing in mind the Tories did increase their vote as well.
Yeah.
It's not like it's all Labour, and it's not like, the Conservatives didn't go forward. They did. But at the same time, there just weren't that many seats that were you could conceivably imagine would flip in order for Corbyn to become Prime Minister. That's no longer true. Tim, from the perspective of someone who kind of watches this stuff more than gets involved, how would you feel about another election? Are you in Brenda's camp?
I would not be happy at all. I think the majority of... I mean, because it's an interesting position here to be able to be firmly in. I am literally just a voter. I may have views that are reflected in what I do, but I'm not involved with campaigning, electioneering of any kind. I think people are sick to the back teeth of it. I think one thing that's been missed is public reaction. I mean, the general public to the referendum. Nobody wants a repeat of that because it genuinely drove a wedge. I know somebody who fell out with his parents who it took them over very little. It took them a long time to rebuild that. Certainly, the only time I ever argued with a group of friends from school days who I see every week, the only time we've ever had a serious argument where people didn't want to turn up the next week was over the referendum. Everyone has no appetite for it anymore. I mean, and the campaigning got nasty in the run-up to this election as well. Even before the election was called, I'd say there's very little political content to what I do. I've been called a Blairite, a Red Tory, a Blue Labour. I don't actually have a defined position, but there are people who treat it kind of like a... like being a football hooligan in the 80s, but with long words. I don't want to see any more of that, really.
It's very interesting because you hear this term voter fatigue, and I sometimes see people like on Twitter and in blogs and stuff say, I don't have any truck with the idea of voter fatigue. All you've got to do is walk up to a polling station and put an X on a piece of paper once every couple of years. What's the problem? But I think you're kind of cutting through to what the problem is. It's not the 10 minutes you spend going down to the ballot, the polling booth. It's the acres of coverage on television. It's the fact that people get drawn into arguments and debates with people. And actually, I mean, think about what we've had in the last few years. You know, we've had the 2015 general election. We've had the EU referendum. We've now had another general election. If you live in Scotland, you had the Scottish referendum in 2014 and Scottish parliamentary elections in 2016. I mean, it's completely understandable, actually, in the context in which you've put it there, that really... are people going to want another election? I mean, Theresa May didn't need to call this one. And I suspect some of the reaction of people not voting Conservative will have been, this can't be a non-zero issue. There must be some people who just didn't bother to turn out because why she bothered calling this election.
And, I mean, another, building on Tim's point, and I think it's interesting that I think Tim's giving the best analysis at the moment of what's going on.
I don't want to say that, but yeah.
Thanks, Tim.
But what all this has shown is that people in politics can do political analysis that sounds very good, but actually probably isn't connected with reality because we think about things in a different way. Polling companies cannot actually tell you what's going to happen, so you can't rely on those. And the actual, all the rules that people have been trying to operate by don't exist anymore. So the idea for anybody to call an election knowing that it'll be a good or bad thing is just completely false, actually. So you'd have to be a bit of a risk taker to do that.
Okay, let's come to Theresa May. I mean, I think it's probably not worth debating whether or not Corbyn's going to remain Labour leader, because I think it's just a nailed on certainty that he's going to be Labour leader for as long as he wants to.
The best things about this result is I don't have to have another bloody summer with a leadership contest.
Yeah. whereas if it had been a different result, that almost certainly would have happened.
Oh, yeah.
But okay, so Corbyn's safe. We know that. Theresa May. Now, she has decided not to resign, which very much surprised me. I was on the radio till 6 a.m. I then went and got 4 hours sleep before I was back on again at 11. And I just assumed by the time I'd woken up, she'd have resigned. If it was Cameron, he'd have resigned. If it was Blair, he'd have resigned. If it's Gordon Brown,
he
wouldn't have resigned, but probably would have done. Sorry?
Ed and Nick Clegg were both gone by that point.
Yes, exactly. So that's your window, isn't it? It's kind of the next morning, people have had a bit of sleep, they've woken up, you resign. But she hasn't done, Nick. What do you think about that?
Do we all remember the film Speed, which relaunched... Do we remember for the film Speed that relaunched Keanu Reeves' career?
Yeah, it couldn't go below 50 miles an hour.
Yeah. On the bus.
Yeah.
Well, basically, we're on that bus. It's called Article 50. We've got a bomb on it, which is a 2-year time frame. And Keanu Reeves is Theresa May.
who's Sandra Bullock? Boris?
No, Corbyn's Sandra Bullock, I think. But so I think... essentially, there is this, you know, the idea of having a couple of months for a Tory leadership election while all this stuff is going on just doesn't really work, does it?
But what kind of authority does Theresa May have in Brexit negotiations?
I don't think she's got... I mean, I think that she... I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. She has no authority left, and yet she... I think she can't resign. I think the Tory bigwigs have said, no, you broke it, you bought it.
Yeah.
You are stuck there because... Yeah, you know, we cannot have a leadership contest right now. You've got to at least lead the government for a little bit, and then you can say, I will leave by X, but I will lead us through this transition. And then you... But even then, who's negotiating
but
with Europe?
Think about what happened with Blair as soon as he announced that he was going to be leaving. All this political authority drained away, and it was all
she
focused on
none,
who was
though,
going
Mark.
To succeed.
What political authority?
No, I accept that she had her political authority and her political capital is massively reduced, but whatever residual authority she still has, if she announces a date at some point in the future...
She's literally just there to steer the ship, just to stand by the rudder.
I don't understand what authority she can have in Brexit negotiations. I almost think, like, you would be better off her resigning 3 months, we get a new Tory leader, there has to be a leadership election as well, because we can't have another coronation, because you've seen where that's led us. So we lose 3 months of Brexit negotiations, but at least we then have a Prime Minister who has the authority to carry it through. She doesn't.
But Mark, if you want to look at this positively... but the authority for Brexit negotiations is no longer the Prime Minister, it's actually Parliament.
So I suppose that is a positive.
And that actually might not be a bad thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
On election night, Ken Clark, you know, said there should be a little less sloganeering and shouting, and a bit more the parties coming together talking, and maybe finding common ground, and if not, obviously disagreeing and finding a way to get through those disagreements. So, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what this really means. We don't know how long Theresa May is going to stay. We don't know if she can change in order to stay, because
I think we do know she can't.
Well, I mean, because she's going to have to show some skills that she's not shown so far, such as, you know, flexibility, charm, and a subtlety.
She needs to sack the toxic twins for a start.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, advisors, bad or good advisors, is ultimately the leaders who take responsibility one way or the other. So, in a very interesting way, this could actually, her weakening of her power could actually increase the power of Parliament in all of this. And for me personally, that's probably quite a good thing.
I think regardless of May's authority, I think Parliament is just going to have to be more involved because of the parliamentary arithmetic. I mean, just to get stuff through, Parliament is going to have to be consulted on all sorts of issues now, not just Brexit.
We are quite lucky because, despite the tabloid caricature, the people we're negotiating with on the other side don't see this as a fight. If they did, they would be laughing at us having thrown ourselves at the mat. But actually, you know, they are a bit less bullish about the head-to-head version of negotiation than we have behaved. And, you know, now we've had our wings clipped. I think if I was Jean-Claude Juncker, if I was...
Donald Tusk.
Michel Barnier. I would be actually like, you know what? Maybe this can actually mean that we can actually have a decent conversation rather than just effigies on the White Cliffs of Dover.
Mm.
And I think, to be honest, the truth about the Brexit situation is it's all in the hands of the EU, really, anyway. Because we can ask for anything and everything, but it's up to them to give us or not give us.
Which is why, I mean, a lot of this, I want the authority to get the best Brexit I can get.
Yeah.
There's 27 other people who actually have that authority to give you, really. Yes. It's not about us. And, you know, as someone who is actually trained in sales negotiation, the way that May was behaving was exactly the way to get a door slammed in your face, not to get a foot through it.
Yeah. Can we talk about young people?
Yes.
You come in here, young,
young
gangs of one and two. I sound like an old fogey, but young people seem to have had a really big effect on this election in a way that hasn't happened in previous elections. So the old trope, the old kind of meme in politics is that young people might talk a good game, and when pollsters ask them what they're going to do, you'll get a certain answer. But in the end, they'll only turn out at like 30%, 40%, whereas old people turn out like 70%, 80%. And that's one of the reasons why, say, over the last 20 years, you've had things like the pensions triple lock, the winter fuel allowance, free TV licences, all of this stuff that's like sugar for older people and pensioners. And younger people have had tuition fees and benefits cut, EMA abolished, you name it. You know, it's all been one way. And what we've seen in this election is that young people have turned out in very large numbers, it looks like. I mean, we're still waiting for the analysis of the data, but even on the night, it was kind of obvious that must have happened for some of the results we were seeing. So, I mean, I personally think that of everything that happened on election night, with the possible exception of the demise of UKIP, but I'd already sort of priced that in. I wasn't expecting young people to vote in these kind of numbers, but I think that's a fantastic thing. Yeah. I've written articles about this. I've made speeches about this. I've talked to groups of children about this, and I've implored them to vote, to get out there and vote. And it doesn't matter who they vote for, just vote. Mm. Because once you start voting, politicians of all parties will start listening to you. Yeah. I mean, that's got to be a good thing, Emma, regardless of anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously delighted that they voted for us. And there is this sort of sense that voting can be habitual. So once you start voting for a party, you have to have your mind changed rather than, making a different choice each time, if you see what I mean. But I think if what this leads to is the two main parties, and that's the other story of this election, of course, is that we're back to two-party politics. But if that means that we start competing for the attention of young people, then that can only be a good thing, because they have been so battered for so long. And, you know, and I would say probably since the coalition, you two might argue that since 2008 and the crash. But I think that certainly young people have had such a raw deal for such a long time that it is just right. It's just their turn for us to actually focus on the future.
Well, I think it's really ironic that this Conservative manifesto actually tried to sort of change things. So it got rid of the triple lock commitment. The social care issue was all about actually people paying for social care.
But you didn't sell it about that.
Well, no, I was just going to come on to that, Emma. But you know, and the apprenticeship stuff. You know, different ways of being able to gain skills to earn more money. The housing thing as well. So in a sense, the Conservative manifesto was sort of already towards that, except we're right, we did it in a terrible way, which was like, we're going to win a majority no matter what, and actually we're going to be responsible now, and so we're going to do these things that are right. We should have gone about the other way, saying it's right to do all those things because we believe in it, please vote for it.
And yeah, and I think what you, in quite an extraordinary way, was instead of saying we're going to redistribute the way that money in government is spent from a massive overfocus on older people to a more fair distribution through the generations, which is one interpretation of your manifesto, to be kind.
Should we sound the unprecedented alarm? Emma's being kind to the Tories.
That's not allowed in left-wing circles.
I was going to say, we're in some parallel universe.
I can be generous and magnanimous at the moment. Yes,
wow. Things really have... rules have all changed, haven't they?
We never did this podcast when we were in government. That's what
to be fair.
But we never did this podcast when we were on the up. But what you did instead was, hey, older people, we're going to hurt you too.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't cast in terms of we're going to help young people. It was we're going to bash old people. Yeah. Now, actually, I don't think the specific policy, what became known as the dementia tax, which I think is a silly name, but hey, it really captured the imagination, didn't it? I think something like that has to happen. I mean, you can't. we've got to do something to help fund older people's care. I mean, the demographic just tell us that has to happen. But I think the way it was executed was very ham-fisted. And the U-turn was even worse.
Yes, indeed. And we're sort of straying off from our initial concept. But, you know, the one of the other things that was obviously really negative during the campaign was when we did an obvious U-turn, Theresa May saying it was not a U-turn. You know, it just, everyone looks at it and goes, okay, no, certainly it was. And that sort of all fed into the repeating sound bites, not actually explaining, not having the conversation in the way Corbyn does, and also not actually turning up and doing debates and all that sort of stuff, which basically created a real negative opinion of what the Conservatives are about and what Conservative motivations are about.
Tim, what do you reckon about this? Young people. You a fan of young people?
How do you answer that?
I thought I'd just bowled you with googly.
Yeah. Jimmy Savile.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems is that people can be very dismissive of... I know, you know... Because I've been one myself, young voters have naive ideals sometimes, can cling too passionately to an idea that's unworkable. But people either dismiss that, patronise them, or ridicule it. I mean, the two things that always come back to me back when I was a first-time voter are, I still can't believe the arrogance of this, I will name names because I was never a fan. David Alton, who was a local MP for a long time. Yeah.
Lib Dem, was he?
He was a Lib Dem.
He was a Catholic Lib Dem. He was the one who tried to stop women getting the pill.
Well, that's what I'm about to come on to, was so he again. Sent out to all the first-time voters in his catchment a copy of his autobiography. Now, the first thing is, mate, you're not Peter O'Toole. No, not worth reading in there. But also the arrogance of, you know, not just what Emma just mentioned, but he'd done things like he'd saber-rattled recently about he tried to bring in a boneheaded new classification system for home video, which had partially enacted. He wanted to bring in the rating system for books. I could be wrong on this, so I'm saying this is as I remember. I think he was involved with cracking down on rave culture to some extent. The arrogance of then sending a book out, you know, saying, this is how wonderful I am, vote for me. That really rankled with me. And the other one that, don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Chris Morris, but I remember on Radio 1, he did the prank where, you know, it sounds quite funny on face value. He posed as somebody chairing a youth voters conference and had set up a thing where an alarm went off every time one of them mentioned the homeless. Which, you know, you laugh along with it when it's on the radio, but afterwards I started to think, that's really not very funny. They might be fixated on the homeless, but these are people who, you know, they're voting for the first time. Yeah. Why not try and engage with them instead of, like, broadcasting it on Radio 1 and laughing, you know? Yeah. And so things like that, I remember being really aggrieved by, and that's why I was very, very wary of, despite people calling me Blair right these days, very wary of Tony Blair, because, you know, the mixing with the Britpop bands and so on seemed to me to be, you know, I actually think some of that was genuine now, but it felt very cynical on face value, you know, and I don't imagine I was alone with that. So if you make fun of young people, they disengage with the whole process.
And I agree, and there's almost like this wider sort of fake authenticity thing. Like, I always used to hate it when David Cameron went on holiday on EasyJet. Because ultimately, David Cameron is
very rich.
He's very rich.
Yeah.
His wife is very rich. If they want to go on holiday, they can fly first class on BA. Everyone knows that. The fact you're going on EasyJet is really actually insulting to me.
Because
what you're saying is, I'm too stupid to realise that. Or B, oh, thank you, Mr. Prime Minister, for slumming it with us.
It's part of the same kind of continuum, though, of things like, you know, where Tony Blair had to pretend he was interested in whether Deirdre was going to go to prison on Coronation Street, or, you know, whether he was in the stands when Jackie Milburn was, you know, putting it in the back of the net in St. James's Park, and actually he wasn't born at that time. Politicians feel like they have to somehow connect the electorate. Exactly. And because most politicians spend most of their time thinking about policy and being, you know, doing things that politicians do, which is not the same as 90-odd% of the population, they feel like they have to say and do these things in order to look like they're connecting with the public. But I personally always respect it when I see politicians. It happens every now and then where they'll be asked a question like, you know, what's your favourite football team or who do you like best in EastEnders? And they just say, I don't watch that. I think Ed Miliband responded like that to a question about EastEnders. And I had a lot of respect for him for saying that.
I agree.
Okay.
And some of them do. I mean, there are, because of the generation that we have in Parliament now, there are some MPs who are real music geeks.
Of course.
And that's part of who they are. And that's why, but it's when they try to pretend
Well, the best example of that was, I don't doubt he might have liked it and not listened to the lyrics, but when David Cameron said his favourite album was London Nil Hull 4 by House Martins, the second song on which has a verse about shooting bankers in the streets, it indicated to me that, should I really believe him?
Yeah, and also, I mean, I don't know if it's on that album, but songs by the House Martins like Flag Day and the People, who Grin Themselves to Death, which is all about the royal family and how terrible it is. And of course, you can't get much more royal than David Cameron, you know, royalist.
Well, didn't he get his first job at CCHQ because of his royal
connections? Yeah, exactly, because I think his dad knew the Queen's equerry or something. I didn't even know
what an equerry is.
No, I don't know what equerry is. I can't even pronounce it.
You don't have an equerry. How the hell have you managed to live so long?
Our Tory friend, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, we probably need to start bringing things to a close because we've been going for a little while now. So maybe just go around the table and just kind of, you know, get your closing thoughts on where we are and, you know, where we think we might be in the near future, Nick.
An interesting, hopefully interesting, random thought. This election was called the Brexit election. Then no one talked about Brexit at all. But actually, we've ended up in a situation that no one would realise, which is painful and difficult, and no one knows what's going to happen. So it probably is the Brexit negotiation after all.
Tim, what do you reckon?
I would hope that people, in a way, that everyone, you know, the politicians, the voters alike, kind of learn from this, that, you know, everybody's fought very angrily. Nobody's got the result they wanted or were expecting. That is literally, I include the Corbynistas in that. I don't think, you know, they're entirely happy with what's happened. Maybe the way forward is everyone engaging with each other a bit more, treating each other with a bit more respect. I mean, I am wondering now, what would have happened if May and Corbyn had actually had some nice friendly chats on the TV instead of, you know, alternatively hiding behind doors and not turning up to things?
It's an interesting point because we haven't even really touched upon the fact that, you know, May just very arrogantly and high-handedly, in my view, just refused to engage with any of that stuff and just, you know, closed it all down. And, you know, I mean, I guess in the election wash-up review stuff we have, you know, as time goes on, maybe that will be identified. But I just thought that was pretty shocking, really. Okay, so shouldn't be forced to go and do a debate she doesn't want to do, but she doesn't seem to want to do anything, really.
You cannot win an election if it looks like you don't like the voters.
Yeah.
I mean,
and she really didn't look like she did.
You know, Corbyn looked like he liked the people. Mm. I mean, what I think will happen now, I think that the wheel has turned very sharply. And I now think that we're going to have a more united Labour Party, not completely united, but more. No party is ever completely united, and a more divided Conservative Party. And I think that's going to be reflected more in the coverage. There's going to be some more reflective coverage. I think that what I would like to see the Labour Party do is keep campaigning Corbyn. Lots of people have said to me, God, I didn't like Corbyn before, but he's been great in the campaign. And that's because that's what his strength is. And, you know, if we can find a way to balance and bring in all the best of what Corbyn can do with some better internal party management, and that, frankly, will have to at least mean a lot of the PLP moving towards him rather than the other.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, there is quite a lot of talent on the backbenches now within the PLP, precisely because, you know, lots of the people who were in the foreground of the Labour Party over the last decade or two, who were still in the PLP, didn't want to serve under Corbyn. But now that he's proved his campaigning mettle and he's managed to increase seats, do you think it's likely that people like, I mean, I'll just pick random names, Chukwuemunna.
Well, Chuck has already said that he will serve in the
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of them, and lots of them have lots of good experience. Some have experience in government. You think they'll come on board now?
I think the majority of them will. And I think that Chuck has quite clearly led the way. Owen Smith did a very good mea culpa. You know, I didn't believe he could do it. He has, therefore we have to row in behind him. And I think that we are suddenly a united party going forward in a positive way. It's not what anyone expected 2 days ago. I was genuinely like, oh God, we're going to have another leadership contest. Oh God, I can't bear it. And now I'm thinking I might get some sunshine this summer.
So you're united behind getting rid of Trident and leaving the EU.
Brilliant. Well,
just saying.
I was going to say that the former was not in our manifesto.
I thought Corbyn dealt with that question pretty well. I mean, he just said that the party's policy is the party's policy. Just because
exactly
he personally would like to get rid of Trident, you know, he actually said, well, that's not the party's policy.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, and quite extraordinarily, he got that line almost directly from Kinnock, because Kinnock was the same. Kinnock was a unilateralist. Mm. But he said, I'm not here to have my personal view. I'm here to represent the views of the party, and the majority of the view of the party is that we retain Trident. And, you know, and that's absolutely fair enough. That's how democracy works, and it's how a democratic party works. Can I just add that I'm starting a new podcast with Professor Steve Fielding, which is going to be looking at politics and popular culture and how they reflect each other.
Oh, brilliant.
We are thinking about names, so if anyone's got any fascinating suggestions, please get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at @EmmaBurnell_.
How about politics?
We might want a more PG rating, okay, but so far the best we've got is the Zeitgeist tapes, but I'm not sure if that's a bit too insidery.
It's a little bit, yeah.
But yeah, so if anyone has any sterling ideas, free the Weatherfield one. But yes, so that will be coming out hopefully at the end of June.
Okay. On that point, I think we should maybe bring it to a close. So maybe we'll do another one of these, maybe fairly soon. It probably won't be face-to-face, but things are changing so rapidly in politics that who knows where we're going to be in a week or a month or 6 months.
We'll do it when you start having your leadership contest, Nick.
But anyway, in the meantime, I'd like to say...
I'll be on a beach.
Yeah. I'd like to say thanks very much to Nick Dennis.
Pleasure to be here.
And thanks to Emma Burnell.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to Tim Worthington.
Thank you.
And it's thanks from me, Mark Thompson. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you to Audio Boom for hosting the podcast, and to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music.